Good morning. I have a bit of a confession to make this morning. I'm a big fan of the movie Footloose. And I'm not talking about the one that came out in 2011. I'm talking about the 1984 Kevin Bacon Footloose. Has anybody seen that? Okay, the first service had a little more representation there for the 1984 film. You can't beat Kevin Bacon, though. Now, if you don't know this movie, the story is of a young urban man who moves to a small rural town where they have outlawed dancing. And he doesn't really fit in very well. He's not totally understood, but he goes on this crusade and eventually succeeds in convincing the town to host a school dance. I remember watching this movie when I was just entering middle school, and this main character's experience of feeling like he didn't quite fit in, like he didn't know how to navigate the social world of this new place, resonated with me a lot. But the thing is, he was Kevin Bacon. So he was cool, right? It's just that other people didn't realize it yet. And over the course of the movie, they eventually became convinced of how cool Kevin Bacon actually is. One of the songs featured in that movie is called "Holdin' Out for a Hero" by Bonnie Tyler. Listen to the lyrics. "I need a hero. I'm holding out for a hero till the end of the night. He's got to be strong, and he's got to be fast, and he's got to be fresh from the fight. I need a hero. I'm holding out for a hero till the morning light. He's got to be sure, and it's got to be soon, and he's got to be larger than life." Now, it's possible that as a middle school boy, I might have watched this movie in my house alone and danced to the scene where this occurred. And that's the reason why we're not going to see a movie clip this morning, because trust me, nobody wants to see that on a Sunday morning. But I resonated with this desire of wanting a hero to come, to save me, to fix what was wrong with my life. And maybe even I could be that hero. Maybe even I was misunderstood and I could rise and be a hero like Kevin Bacon. I think there are times when we want to be rescued. We want a hero to step in and save the day. Last week, we kicked off our 10-month journey through the life of David. We're calling this series A Life of Passion. We're going to spend a lot of time immersed in David's life. As it turns out, his story is the story of a hero. It's about a nation who desperately longs for someone to come and save them, and God gives them someone. The question that we ask all throughout the story of David is whether or not he really was the hero that God's people needed. And we'll wrestle with that as we try to understand him. But before we get to David, there's another person that sets the stage for understanding who he is. A few weeks ago when Corey preached on 1 Samuel 8, she talked about that point when the nation begged God for a hero. They said, "Give us a king." And God said, "Okay, here's your king." But that first hero didn't work out. Saul was not the king that God's people needed. Saul was a failed hero. Now, when authors write a story and they want you to understand a main character, they often use this trick where they will introduce a character first who contrasts with the main character in such a way that you really get to know the strength of the guy they're interested in. So if the main character is really strong, you might start off by meeting a weakling. If the main character is really smart, you might start off by meeting somebody who doesn't quite have it all together. We thought we might put this into practice next week by having me lead worship so you could, you know, appreciate Jake some more. But again, nobody wants that. King Saul is that kind of contrast with David. This is called a foil. He shows us what David isn't. And what Saul lacks, David makes up for. David is everything that Saul isn't. And I want us to see this morning, what I want to suggest to us is that the particular way that Saul fails as king is the thing that is so remarkable about David. To get a picture of that, we're going to summarize most of the early part of Saul's reign. We'll start in 1 Samuel 9, we'll work our way through 1 Samuel 15, until next week when we actually meet David in 1 Samuel 16. But this morning, first we'll see how Saul was chosen. What were the qualifications that made him king. Then we'll see how he failed, what mistakes he made that ended up disqualifying him from being king. We'll see then how he responds to being challenged about those mistakes. And finally, we'll see the consequences that come as a result of his decisions. What we're going to notice is that Saul had it all on the outside. He was competent, winsome, strategic, charismatic, hardworking. But none of that ended up mattering because he lacked something on the inside. Something within him just wasn't right. His solution was to cover it up, to try to hide, to try to conceal what he knew to be true within him. And we're going to see that that's what ended up making everything fall apart for Saul. And watching him fail as a hero is going to be helpful for us because we are tempted to do the exact same thing that Saul does, especially in the world we live in that worships competence and achievement and image. It is so easy to try to work our hardest to make everything look good. Saul's failure is like a pit that always lies before us. So I'm hopeful that seeing the mistakes he makes can help us to avoid them ourselves. We'll start by seeing how he's chosen. We love to be picked, to be selected for some responsibility. And Saul was chosen for the most significant role that anyone could or has ever played in the nation of Israel. Listen to how we meet Saul. This is 1 Samuel 9, verses 1 to 2. There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, son of Zeror, son of Bechorath, son of Aphiah, a Benjaminite, a man of wealth. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a handsome young man. There was not a man among the people of Israel more handsome than he. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. Now, the way a character is first introduced in a story is really significant. That shows us who they are. So when we first meet Saul, we notice that he's given this long genealogy. You wouldn't have a genealogy like this unless your family was respected. He came from good roots. His father was rich. He had money, old money. He was young. He was handsome. Two more wins for Saul. And of course, he was tall, taller than anyone else. Now, in ancient Israel, being tall didn't mean you could win at pickup basketball. It meant that you were more likely to survive a battle. You had a distinct military advantage because of your height. Saul even has the right name. The word for Saul is related to the Hebrew word for asked, and it's often used in this context of somebody begging for something from someone, often God. So the name Saul is thought to have the connotation of the one who is asked for, the one we wanted. Saul's very name suggests that he might be the hero we're holding out for. He had it all. Good family, money, looks, military strength, the right name. And as soon as we meet this guy, we know he's the kind of guy we want to be our king. Now, apparently God thought so too, because throughout 1 Samuel 9 and 10, there are three different stories showing how God chose Saul to be the king. First, there's this private anointing by Samuel. Then Saul leaves that, and he is overcome by the Spirit of God and is said that he prophesies among the prophets, validating that God has filled him for the purpose of being king. And finally, there's this public lot selection ceremony where Saul is chosen among everybody gathered to be the king. Everything points to Saul being the king of Israel that the people had longed for. Saul is the man. Or is he? See, all throughout these stories, there are these unaccounted for incidents. There are these strange things that come up that are hard to explain. We first meet Saul when he's sent on a mission from his father. Some donkeys have gone missing from the family farm, and Saul is sent to look for them. Now, have you ever met a donkey? Yes, thank you. One person. Donkeys aren't known for their brilliant strategy. They're not particularly smart. They're quite loud. They have a bray that can be heard for almost 2 miles at times. And they're kind of just hardworking pack animals. So being sent to look for a pack of lost donkeys is not like rocket science, all right? This should be an easy task. But Saul can't find them. And this whole scene is a little bit like slapstick comedy. It's like bending over to pick something up and you slip on a banana peel and you hit your head. And it's like things keep happening over and over again. So Saul can't find the donkeys and he says to his servant, "We just better go back. I don't want my dad to worry about me. You know, it's not worry about the donkeys, it's worry about me." And the servant says, "Well, there's a city over there. They have a prophet. Let's go ask the prophet. Maybe he knows." And Saul goes, "Oh, shoot, I forgot my wallet though." And his servant has to spot him the cash to pay off the prophet to prophesy of where the lost donkeys might be. And so you meet this guy and you go, "Is this really the kind of guy we want to be our king?" When they do get to Samuel, Samuel says, "Oh, the donkeys? Somebody else found them a long time ago. No big deal." But Samuel says, "I've got a very special thing for you." And he invites Saul to this ceremony. Saul's response is curious. We're not sure quite what to make of it. Listen to verse 21 of chapter 9. Saul answered, "Am I not a Benjaminite from the least of the tribes of Israel? And is not my clan the humblest of all the clans of the tribe of Benjamin? Why then have you spoken to me in this way?" Now, we don't know quite what to do with this response because these things aren't true. Benjamin was not the least of the tribes. In fact, it was one of the most powerful tribes. We already know that his clan, his family, was not a humble clan. They were wealthy. They were respected. So either Saul's being humble and modest, or something else is going on. Maybe he's got this insecurity, this fear within him. We don't hear any more dialogue from Saul the whole rest of this account. It's not until he gets home after Samuel anoints him king, and his dad says, hey, what took so long? I just sent you to get the donkeys. And Saul says, "Well, we ran into the prophet, and that took a while." Completely leaving out the fact that he got anointed king over the country. And it's kind of like, you know, a high schooler, a kid comes home from school, and you say, "Well, how was your day?" "Fine." And you think, "Well, you know, there's a whole 8 hours. Like, something must have happened." "Ah, nothing." It's kind of what Saul says, right? He's completely internalized, and it's as if he's overwhelmed. He doesn't know what to do. You almost feel like he's in tension with himself. What just happened? And it gets worse. Samuel decides to host a public ceremony where all the people will gather and select the king. So they do that, and first, Saul's tribe is chosen by lot, and then his family is chosen by lot. And then Saul himself is selected by lot. So they look for Saul, and no one can find him. Here's 1 Samuel 10, starting in verse 21. When they sought him, he could not be found. So they inquired again of the Lord, "Is there a man still to come? Is this guy real?" And the Lord said, "Behold, he has hidden himself among the baggage." Then they ran and took him from there. And when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. And later on, they say, "This is our king. Long live the king." Now, this is really bizarre. The whole nation is gathered to crown a king. Saul knows that he is the guy. Twice already, he has been confirmed as the next king, the first king. And where is he? He's hiding under the suitcases. So God himself has to tell the people, "The guy I've chosen to lead you, he's hiding under the bags. Go dig him out and put a crown on his head." And so they go and they find him, and this is real kind of indicative of how easy it is in a political process to impress people. The people say, "Oh, he's tall. We love him. Let's make him our king," right? And there it is. Saul is the first king of Israel. Now, the picture that we see of Saul in these opening chapters is of a guy who's externally got it all. Everybody loves him. Everybody's amazed by him. He looks really good, but he's desperately unsure of himself. He can't find lost donkeys. He can't believe anybody would pay attention to himself. He doesn't understand why he might be selected king. When he is finally chosen, he hides under the suitcases. He looks good on the outside, but inside, he's full of insecurity and anxiety. Does this sound familiar at all? There's a phenomenon that's on the rise in many parts of our culture called the imposter syndrome. I read an article in Forbes titled, "Afraid of Being Found Out? How to Overcome Imposter Syndrome." The article quotes a managing partner at a major accounting firm who says to herself, "What are you doing here? You're going to be found out." Kate Winslet, an Academy Award-winning actress, is quoted as saying, "I'd wake up in the morning before going off to a shoot and think, I can't do this. I'm a fraud." I think this is what Saul felt. He knew he looked competent, but he didn't feel competent. He felt like a fraud. I don't think Saul is the only one that feels this way. I've heard this described by college students and parents, by children, by executives, by seniors, by teens. We can all have a sense of knowing that something is true within us and worrying that people might find that out. Do you ever feel like that? Do you feel like an imposter? I know I sometimes do. I've had some of those exact thoughts, wondering why God has put me in the places he's put me. Worrying, what if anybody finds out what's really true? What if they knew what I thought or what I felt? Now, I try to be pretty open about what's going on. It's not as if there's a secret life, but there's been mistakes and there's been struggles. Sometimes I feel like I don't belong preaching God's word. I don't deserve to be a father, to be a pastor, to be a husband. Someday somebody's going to realize that. Someday I too might be found out. What do we do when we think that way? How do we handle those fears? Does Forbes have the answer? 5 ways to overcome the imposter syndrome? Where do we go with it? As Saul's story continues, we will see the choices he makes, and I hope we will learn from them. I'm convinced that it's not the fact that he felt like a fraud, but it's what he did with those feelings that brings Saul down. Let's see how it plays out. He makes some mistakes as king, no doubt about that. And you can't blame him. You can't blame him for that. Everybody makes mistakes. In the story, 2 particular mistakes are highlighted as the reasons why he loses the kingship. God says because of what he did in those 2 places, he will find somebody else to replace him. We've looked at how Saul was chosen. Now we're going to see how he fails as king. The first one occurs in 1 Samuel 13. Saul had been king for about 2 years at this point. He'd won an early victory over the Philistines, but then they had went off and regrouped and gathered, and they came back in much greater forces, so much so that the people of God were scared. They were literally hiding in caves. And this is what happened. Chapter 13, verse 7. Saul was still at Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. He waited 7 days, the time appointed by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. So Saul said, "Bring the burnt offering here to me and the peace offerings." And he offered the burnt offering. Samuel had apparently told Saul, "Wait for me for up to a week. I'll come, I'll offer the sacrifice so that the fight will go well." And Saul said, "Okay, I'll try." And he waits most of the time, but then right at the end, he notices the people are leaving. He gets scared, so he offers the sacrifice. And from an objective perspective, we might say, well, you know, it's not that big a deal, right? I mean, he was decisive. This is what we want from our leaders. He took action. He knew what needed to be done, and he did it. So why is this such a big deal? Well, before we answer that, let's look at the other incident where Saul messes up. This is in 1 Samuel 15. In this case, God had charged Saul with carrying out the vengeance of God. Generations earlier, the Amalekites had mistreated God's people. And because of that, God decides that he will execute vengeance through Saul and his efforts. This is what Grace artfully paraphrased for us. Begins in chapter 15, I'm going to read verse 3. This is God's command to Saul. "Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction all that they have. Do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." God is clear. He is executing justice against the Amalekites. Saul is charged with destroying everything. And I think he was particularly excited about killing the donkeys because, you know, they'd given him some trouble before. Now, I realize that this command of God's raises some questions for us. This is one of the commands of a set of similar commands in the Old Testament that makes us wonder about God's character. How could he command absolute destruction? Now, we don't have time to go into all the reasons. It has to do partly with God's justice, partly with the severity of idolatry in the ancient times, and partly with the unique period of history when God's people were coming into the promised land. If you want to do some more study on this, I've written up some notes, posted them on the sermon webpage on our website for this sermon, and I promise you that they will not answer all your questions. But it's a good start, and if you'd like to look into it, there's some resources listed on those notes as well. For our purposes this morning, we just need to understand what God commanded. We can't get completely comfortable with exactly why he commanded that. Everything was supposed to be destroyed. And this is what ended up happening. Here's verses 8 through 9. "He took Agag," that is Saul, "took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive and devoted to destruction all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and of the oxen and of the fattened calves and the lambs and all that was good and would not utterly destroy them. All that was despised and worthless they devoted to destruction." You might notice that the donkeys didn't make it. Well, Saul did attack the Amalekites. He did kill all the people, men, women, and children, except for the king. He fulfilled most of the command, but he kept the king alive, and he kept the best property, the sheep, the fattened calves, the oxen. It says that Saul kept all that was good, but all that was worthless he destroyed. So in Saul's mind, the people were worthless, but the stuff was valuable. So he keeps the stuff. Now, what do we make of Saul? What do we make of these two decisions? One, he gets impatient. He offers the sacrifice before the regular time. Two, he halfway obeys God, carries out most of the command, but he keeps all the valuables. Well, if we can summarize Saul, I think the best word to describe him would be a pragmatist. Saul does what makes the most sense at the current time. That's not necessarily a bad thing. Being pragmatic is sometimes very useful, except when it violates the clear command of Scripture, which in this case, it does in both accounts. It might make us think about ourselves. What about us? Do others look at our choices and think, oh yeah, all of those decisions make complete sense? If so, we might question some of them and say, well, do we only follow what makes sense? Are you willing to trust God when things might not make sense? Or are you ruled by what makes sense? Sometimes the commands of God are confusing. Sometimes we can't understand them. They only make sense if there's something deeper, if there's something more besides what we can see. But if you suffer from the imposter syndrome, then it's really tempting to become a pragmatist because you're worried about what lies underneath. You think the outside looks good, and so you desperately try to keep up appearances. So when you make decisions, you can't do something that looks strange, that looks questionable, because you're worried that people might get below the surface, and so you can't give them any reason to find out what lies underneath. All you can count on is what other people can see. You become a slave to common sense. I think this is what happened to Saul, and it becomes especially apparent, not just in his decisions, but as we read about his responses when he's challenged about those choices. See, I don't think he's blown it yet. He hasn't suffered consequences yet, not because of these decisions. It's in the response where he really fails. And I think when we read this, it's going to feel familiar. Unfortunately, these are things that we tend to do, patterns that we tend to fall into. We respond the same way when our mistakes are pointed out. After each of these incidents, Samuel confronts Saul. He says, "Look, you didn't do what you were supposed to do." And when people are confronted, that's when their true character often emerges. That's when you really find out what lies at the heart. Now we see the real Saul. After he offers the early sacrifice, Samuel shows up in the next moment. Here's 1 Samuel 13, verses 11 to 12. This is what Samuel says. "What have you done?" And Saul said, "When I saw that the people were scattering from me, and that you did not come within the days appointed, and that the Philistines had mustered at Michmash, I said, 'Now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the favor of the Lord.' So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering." Don't you love Saul? Everybody around him is at fault. "I saw that the people were scattering." He tells Samuel, "You did not come. The Philistines had mustered. God wasn't yet pleased. Everybody else is at fault." So finally, he says, "I didn't want to do it, but I forced myself to offer the sacrifice." I mean, that's like an Academy Award right there, right? The other story is pretty similar. Samuel confronts Saul again, and this is one of the funniest scenes in the Bible. After the battle with the Amalekites, Samuel checks in on Saul and says, "Hey, how'd it go?" We find out, starting in verse 13, Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said to him, "Blessed be you to the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord. I did everything you asked." And Samuel said, "What then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen that I hear?" See, again, Saul is classic. He says, "I've performed the commandment of the Lord. I did it all." And yet there's clear evidence to the contrary. This week I saw a great YouTube video. It's a little 3-year-old girl, and her face is covered in Nutella. And her mom comes up to her and asks her, "Honey, did you get into the Nutella?" And she says, "No, nope." And her mom says, I think you might have gotten into the Nutella, did you?" "No, I did not touch the Nutella." And over again, she's asked, "What were you doing?" And finally, the mom says, "Well, honey, what were you doing?" And she said, "I was cleaning the dishes, that's all." And you think, boy, you know, how do you maintain a lie when the evidence is so overwhelmingly against you? But that's Saul. He says, "I did it all, and don't pay attention to the sheep that are right here next to me." But then, of course, he realizes, not a stupid guy, he realizes he can't maintain the lie forever, so he goes back to his other strategy, blaming everybody else. He says, "The people spared the best of the sheep and of the oxen to sacrifice to who? The Lord your God, Samuel." See, everybody else is at fault. Now, if you're looking for a mentor on how to be defensive, Saul is your guy. You can learn a lot from him. The problem, of course, is that most of us don't need a mentor. It comes pretty naturally to be defensive when we're challenged. It's been happening for generations. Remember what happened when Adam ate the forbidden fruit? God comes down and asks him what happened, and here's what Adam said in Genesis 3, verse 12. "The man said, 'The woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me fruit of the tree, and I ate.'" It's her fault. "You gave her to me, and she made me do it. Nobody else, I'm not to blame at all. It's only everybody else." And I think this is the human condition of sin. that when we're challenged, we deflect, we blame, we rationalize, we point the finger at someone else. The truth is, and I've learned this the hard way over and over again, that being defensive destroys relationships. It takes away intimacy. It destroys trust. It makes it impossible to love, to really know, when all you're focused on is what the other people around you are doing wrong. What about you? Do you blame others? Do you get defensive? I know it's not your fault you get defensive. You learned it from your parents. I get it. It's never our fault. See, what Saul doesn't realize is that when Samuel confronts him, this is an opportunity. This is a holy moment. This could be the turning point for him. Remember, up until now, there's been no consequences. He's just being asked, what happened? But it's here that he really rejects God. It's here that he pushes Samuel away, that he pushes God away, that he says, I want no part to do with the truth. All I'm going to do is work as hard as I can to maintain appearances. He only loses the kingship when he makes it clear that he's not willing to go into the deep places of his heart. Saul doesn't get it. It doesn't matter that he doesn't feel adequate. It doesn't matter that he thinks he's a fraud. Samuel gives him a chance here to come before God and be known. And he spits in Samuel's face. And he says, no. Eventually, of course, he apologizes because there's nothing else left to try. But at that point, it's empty. He's just trying to work the system. What do you do when you're found out? Do you recognize that opportunity before you? Well, Saul didn't, and God gave him consequences, extreme consequences. After the early sacrifice, Samuel says this, again in chapter 13, verses 13 to 14. Samuel said to Saul, "You have done foolishly. You have not kept the command of the Lord, your God, with which he commanded you, for then the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be prince over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." After the battle with the Amalekites, Samuel says something similar. Chapter 15, verse 23. "For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and presumption is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king." So Samuel tells Saul, you've lost the kingship. But he explains that what he's doing is only making clear the consequences of Saul's own actions. He says, it's not that God rejected you, it's that you rejected God. And when you reject God, you reject the role that he chooses for you. See, God is the real king of Israel. Saul is just a stand-in. So if Saul rejects God and turns away from him, he's thrown away the kingdom himself. The only thing that matters to be king of Israel is your relationship with God, the true king. It's not your economic policy. It's not your military strength. It's not how tall you are. It's just where you are with God. And Saul makes it clear that he's not willing to go there. He closes himself off. He tries to hide from God himself. This picture of Saul shows us what not to do. This is the contrast that will set us up for seeing who David really is. And we will see how differently David responds to God than Saul did. David somehow has this openness to God. It seems like he actually makes worse mistakes. He rapes a woman and murders her husband. Saul steps in and offers the sacrifice when he's not supposed to. That's a hard tension to understand. But I think it has something to do with the imposter syndrome. Something to do with Saul's unwillingness to lay himself bare before God and be found out. What about us? Are we more like Saul or more like David? Are we willing to be open before God? Are you open before God? The truth is that we're all frauds. All of us, every single one of us in the room is an imposter. We hide all the stuff within us as much as we try to share. We don't deserve to be here. We don't deserve the very breath in our lungs. And yet God is gracious on each of us. Paul summarizes it in Romans 3 saying, "None is righteous. No, not one." Many of us look good on the outside. Some have education. Some have careers, personality, money. But deep within, we all know that there is something broken in our hearts. We have doubts, insecurities, fears, guilt over mistakes we've made, regrets. We worry that others will find out what is really true of us. And we are bombarded by messages in the world, the people around us, saying even though we might look good, we can never measure up. We're never smart enough. We're never as good as others. We're never really winning. The world whispers in our ears, "You're not good enough, and you never will be." But in that moment, we have an opportunity, because it is there, at that place where God steps in, where the gospel responds, and where our God takes over, if we will let him. When the world whispers, "You're not good enough," the gospel thunders in response, "You don't have to be." Because our God welcomes frauds. He heals imposters. He reveals the truth so that he can love us in all that we are, so that he can accept us, so that he can change us, so that we can be with him and be with others. Our God forgives sinners and heals the brokenhearted. Have you ever eaten a mango? Some of my kids like mangoes, but I find them really hard to cut. I don't really understand the fruit, to be honest. There's something inside. It's not a pit. It's not a core. It's some weird thing. So when I try and cut it, it ends up all stringy and juicy and just a mess. But I've seen people who know how to cut mangoes, and they slice them, and they somehow cut it out, and then they carve a little, like, checker pattern on the peel, and then they flip the peel out. Have you seen this? And then you can just eat the delicious fruit cleanly and perfectly. That's the image that comes to me, the way we could live, of just flipping ourselves out. What if we let what was inside be on the outside? What if we let ourselves be known? What if we were open to God, if we didn't hold him at bay? What if we were open with each other, shared about our fears, our doubts, our failures? Because of the gospel, when we do that, it's freedom. We're actually known. We're actually loved. I think this is part of what Jesus meant in John 8 when he said, "You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." It's terrifying and it's risky, but all freedom is. When you live this way, when you're open before God and open before others, you experience real freedom. What about you? Can you be open before God? Can you take that risk? Or are you too busy defending and blaming and hiding? We all want a hero. We want someone who looks good, somebody who's charming, who comes from a good family, someone with money, attractive, confident, capable. We want someone like Saul to step in and rescue us. But then Jesus is born to an unwed teen girl who lives in poverty. As an adult, he is defeated and rejected. His body is mangled and abused. He hangs on a cross, humiliated the ultimate failure. Saul is everything we want from a hero, but Jesus is everything we need. If you feel like an imposter, if you think that being found out is the worst thing that could ever happen to you, I want to suggest that maybe it's the best thing. Maybe being found out is just what you need. Because in that moment, if you're open to God, there's a whole new world that lies before you. Admit your brokenness. Open yourself up. Be rescued by a hero who himself was broken. Come to God. Ask forgiveness from your friends and your family. Be honest with your brokenness. You may be a fraud, but Jesus is the real thing. Come to him, be open to Jesus, and find life. Amen.